92-CR State v. Johnny L. Green. Mr. Griswold, representing Mr. Green. You may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Nick Griswold. I represent the defendant petitioner in this matter, Johnny L. Green. This matter comes before the court on three separate and distinct issues, the first of which is what level or of proof must the defendant establish in order to obtain discovery of a witnesses or complaining witnesses, counseling or medical records. In a related issue, the court is also being asked to address what standard a review of this court should apply or an appellate court should apply in reviewing a trial court's decision on such a matter. And lastly, we're asking the court to take up the matter of whether or not a prosecutor violates a sequestration order by communicating with the state's witness during the course of a trial. The facts in this case are unfortunately somewhat not unusual. A young girl, made an allegation of sexual assault. She alleged that the assault occurred in November of 1996. She made this allegation approximately 4 months after the assault allegedly occurred. That resulted in some investigation, but no action was taken by the authorities until January 15th of 1999, approximately 2 years after the incident was brought to the authorities' attention. She also changed her story several times during the course of the investigation, and that culminated in October of 1998 when she alleged for the first time that there had been actual penetration of her vagina to the authorities. During the course of the pretrial discovery, it came to the attention of trial counsel for Mr. Green that the witness, this child, was in counseling and being seen by a counselor. At that point, he asked, made a motion to the trial court and requested that he be provided with copies of those counseling records. That request was denied by the trial court. And it brings us to our first issue. Mr. Green is alleging and contending that he should have been entitled to an in-camera review of those records by the trial court judge to determine whether or not they were material to his defense.
Mr. Griswold, if I can interrupt for a minute, let me ask you, what was the presentation made by defense counsel in support of that request? In other words, what was presented by way of affidavit, or was it strictly argument?
It was an argument, Your Honor. He argued at a pretrial motion before the court that the materials would have been relevant given the constantly changing story given by the child in this matter, and that he asked for permission to file a written motion, I believe. That request was, after some argument before the trial court, was denied. No motion for reconsideration was ever filed, but he did present his motion orally.
And his oral motion was based chiefly on the idea that there had been several versions testified to by this child or presented in different contexts?
Yeah, presented in different contexts, either through the authorities or through social work, social services agencies.
Thank you.
Okay. This issue that is raised before the court essentially involves, in my opinion, a balancing act between, or a balancing process, if you will, between the privacy rights of witnesses of all types and the defendant's right to present an argument or present a defense under the Due Process Clause. But the case also has an interesting twist, because apparently there was a release signed by this child's mother, which the state has apparently acknowledged would have allowed the state to get these medical records, these counseling records that were involved here. The mother apparently signed those releases, and I, it's to my knowledge, the state never obtained a copy of them, but apparently they did have the authority under that release to obtain a copy of those records. Based on that admission in the state's brief, Mr. Green has kind of made an argument, and we've made an argument we would assert here, that any privacy issue that was involved in these records was waived, and we would refer the court to, the court's decision, the appellate court's, the Court of Appeals decision in Spicy, where the court in that case referenced several Supreme Court cases. I believe it was Farmers Mutual Insurance and then an older case, Woodman Accident Company, in which those courts indicated that it would be unfair to permit the state access to a counseling records or any sort of records as a result of a waiver of a privilege and not allow that information to be given to defense counsel as well. And Mr. Green would assert that waiver that was signed would alleviate the need to delve any farther into this issue in the fact that any privacy issue would have been waived and therefore the balancing isn't required because the privilege has been waived.
Did you raise that issue at the Court of Appeals?
No, we did not, Your Honor, and it was not raised at the Court of Appeals because at the time it was unclear as to whether or not the release that was signed would in fact have allowed the state to obtain the records. It was in the state's brief before this court that they acknowledged that in fact that release, which would have allowed, at least in theory, I guess that's the way they phrase it, to the state to obtain those records.
So you have raised this for the first time on this appeal?
Yes, because as I indicated before.
In your reply brief?
Yes.
Well, I read your reply brief, and I don't know exactly where you're referring to, where you raised it. Could you point that out?
Sure, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, I'm very slow this week, but...
It would be on pages 3 and 4 of the reply brief. The issue of the waiver, or the issue of the release, had in fact been raised to or acknowledged in the Court of Appeals in footnotes in the briefs and whatnot, but at the time I believe that both sides indicated they were uncertain as to whether or not that release, because the release had never been made part of the record, and it was unclear. I think there was actually some discussion when I made my post-conviction motion about the release, but the court did not, the trial court, that is, did not have a copy of it, and the state never obtained a copy of it. But at this court, the state has acknowledged, at least that's our argument, that they have been able to obtain those records via that release.
If I understand the facts, the state could have had access because there was a release, but the state did not take advantage of having the access.
That is correct. And we've argued that merely the fact that the state could have had access to those under those prior precedents would require that Mr. Green be given those as well.
I'd like you to state, if you would, I know it's in your brief, but let's just, I think it's a brief, I think it's at page 13, your brief. I'm looking for the test you want this court to clearly set forth.
Yes.
As to what you must show to get an in-camera review. That's the issue of the case,
yeah.
Right? Okay. The appellant would urge this court to apply the relevant and maybe helpful language in analyzing a defendant's preliminary request for an in-camera review. The standard strikes an appropriate balance. So give me the full test.
Your Honor, I think that the test set forth by the New Hampshire Supreme Court and the case, I believe it's Hogue.
That's the Hogue case?
Yes.
Where's that? Okay.
Pardon me?
Is it in your brief? I know the Hogue case is in your brief. What page is the test?
Oh.
Or you can give it to me orally. Doesn't matter.
Okay. Well, essentially, Your Honor, it would be that the defendant must set forth some plausible theory of relevance and materiality. The
defendant must set forth a plausible
theory of relevance and materiality. It must be based on more than mere conjecture. And it must... I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
The defendant must set forth a plausible theory of relevance and materiality based on more than conjecture.
Yeah, that the information sought...
And it can't be mere speculation.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
And it cannot be mere speculation.
Yes.
You agree with that?
And that the information that's requested would be... needed, or actually may be needed, to support the defendant's theory of defense. Which is essentially a paraphrase of the Hogue court's decision, which I've referenced in my brief. As I was indicating, assuming that we don't reach the issue of this release that was signed by the child's mother, we need to set forth a standard that's appropriate for when an in-camera review is necessary. And I think it's important in that case to distinguish between the standard of materiality which is needed to demonstrate or once an in-camera review has been granted. In other words, court grants an in-camera review, a trial court grants an in-camera review, the records are brought before it, the court reviews it, and then there is a standard of materiality which is not at issue here, but which seems to have been set forth in the Ritchie case and in, by this court, or the Court of Appeals in the Richard A.P. case, which indicates that evidence is material if there is a reasonable probability that had the evidence been disclosed to the defense, the results of the proceedings would have been different. That standard is not the standard we're asking for in this case. This case deals with the preliminary matter of what record should be provided to a trial court for in-camera review to determine if this standard is met. And that is the problem that the petitioner and the defense in this matter have with the state's analysis, in that their analysis would call for a defendant to show and to make a specific preliminary showing that the evidence is relevant and material to the issues and likely exculpatory to the defendant. That, to me, is very similar to the standard that the court implies once they're looking at the records. The reasonable probability language necessary to show that to allow the records actually to be turned over or be discoverable to the defense is very similar to this likely exculpatory language which the state has provided for us. And I think that it's wrong to blur those two arguments, particularly in light of the fact that we're dealing here with something that's being done pre-trial, where the defense has not had the opportunity to review any records, but they've not had an opportunity to hear what the witnesses are actually going to have to say.
Mr. Griswold, let's assume for a minute that the second statement in Shifra is the rule that is in effect in Wisconsin, that the statement to the effect that the records have to be relevant and may be necessary to a fair determination of guilt or innocence.
Yes.
If that's the standard, is it your argument that the presentation that was made to the trial court met that standard? Or do you win only if you can get this court to go along with something along the lines of may be helpful? The other formulation of the standard that was talked about in Schiffer.
Well, Your Honor, I, as I argued in my reply brief, I think that the may be helpful and the may be necessary language are blurred a great deal. They both begin with the word maybe, which I think is important here, meaning there's a possibility that it might be necessary or there's a possibility that it might be helpful. Not necessarily that it is helpful or that's likely to be helpful or that it's expected to be helpful, but rather that it's possible that it may be helpful or it may be necessary. Additionally, I believe that the necessary versus helpful language is blurred somewhat because something that is going to be necessary typically will be helpful as well. So there's only going to be some instances where something is going to be helpful and not be necessary. Now, I know that I'm getting to the answer to your question, but we have a more difficult problem with the way the state has interpreted their case. We believe that, or the way the state has interpreted the reason, or maybe necessary language, excuse me, we believe that the Hoag interpretation of the maybe necessary or the maybe helpful language is appropriate. And I believe that under either analysis, the maybe helpful or the maybe necessary language, if the court applies this Hoag interpretation of those words, that Mr. Green has provided sufficient basis for this court to rule in his favor.
Well, I'm just going to ask the state what its test is, but I'm looking at the bottom of page 16 of the state's brief, and it also is on, I think, 11 and 12 of the state's brief. And it says, Green must make a specific showing the sought-after materials, records are material, phrased differently, consequential to the defense. You use the word materials. You agree that it has to be material, right? I'm just going to take you one step at a time.
Okay, which are we looking at, page 16?
Bottom of 16. Green must make a specific showing of the sought-after materials. Last paragraph.
Yes,
I see. Are material or consequential. You agree that materiality is an important issue, right?
I agree with that. I believe that the definition of materiality may come into play, but yes, obviously.
Material means consequential to an issue in the case.
Which would essentially be relevant, so.
Well, relevancy in Wisconsin includes materiality, so, but you decided to use two words, so probative is what relevant may mean. It's defined as materiality. So relevance and materiality are part of the state's statement too. And that I assume the state would agree that it can't be a conjecture, right?
Yeah.
All right. It seems to me the difference between you and the state is that you want defendant to be able to set forth a plausible theory of relevance or materiality or both, and they want a specific showing that the sought-after records are material. Now, maybe I'm not seeing the real difference. If I am not seeing the real difference, you tell me what the real difference is between
the
state.
No, I believe that's correct, Your Honor. I think that their showing or their standard that they're setting forth is a much more specific standard, and they're also requiring not just something to be material, but to actually the defendant to prove that it's likely exculpatory. They indicate that in their test on page 18, where it says the state submits that a reasonable interpretation of the relevant and maybe necessary language and then there's some other verbiage, would be for the defense to make a specific preliminary showing that the counseling records will produce evidence that is relevant to a material issue in dispute, and I think we've discussed that.
Exculpatory, right. So that's what, and you don't think it has to be likely exculpatory?
I'm sorry, Aaron, what was that?
You don't think that you have to make a showing that these evidence would be likely exculpatory?
No, Your Honor. I think
just has to support a theory of defense.
Yeah. I don't believe that to demonstrate that something that's never been seen and that the defendant doesn't have access to in a pretrial setting is likely exculpatory would be next to impossible.
I might be generalizing too much. I see the essence of the difference being that you are suggesting in your standard that it has to meet a standard of whether it may be needed, which I say is the same as may be necessary, which to me looks a lot like the second Shifra approach. And so I categorize your approach as may be needed or necessary. And I categorize the state's approach as the difference between maybe, which is possible, and likely, which is probable. In other words,
yes.
But both are, you know, one may be necessary, which means it's less than 50%, and the other one is likely to be, probably will be. That's the way I characterize the two different approaches. Now, tell me if I'm wrong. I may be wrong on that. Tell me if I am. Is your approach that it may be needed, is that the same as may be necessary?
Yes. But that language, I think, isn't as important as the language that's used and that the state and I think the defense as well has used to interpret those words. I mean, those words necessarily aren't all that helpful. May be necessary. I think that there's language that the state has suggested and the state language that the defense has suggested that to interpret those words that are more important, and the state has chosen to use words likely, that the evidence is likely exculpatory, which doesn't even comport with the maybe needed or language that they've suggested. I see that my warning light is on here.
What else do you want to say in 5 minutes?
I think I may like to do that, but I will answer the justice's question, of course.
Well, I have a problem with both theories. And I think that the two justices on my sides have essentially stated them, and both are, I think, correct. On the one hand, the state's, I agree with you that the state's position, for the most part, is impossible to meet because no one has seen these records yet.
Yes.
On the other hand, yours, which is maybe necessary, or put in the words of the chief, that there's a plausible theory that would support the demand for the records. What it seems to me does just the opposite. In other words, makes these records available all the time. And I don't think that's what the law envisions either.
Well, I don't think that's what the law envisions either, but I think that at the very minimum, under the theory that we've proposed, simply alleging that a victim or a witness is in counseling would not be sufficient. In this case, we know a couple of more things. Number one, we know that as part of her counseling, she's communicated with the counselor regarding this incident, regarding this assault.
How do you know that?
It's indicated in part of the record that's been submitted to the court. It was indicated, I believe, at the trial as well. But there's also a report that, a social worker's report that's contained in the appellate record that indicates that she was seeing this counselor and that she had discussed this matter with her counselor. So I think that it's not a free-for-all because a lot of times that information won't be disclosed to anybody. We won't know what is going on in counseling. And in that case, clearly, it's almost an impossible burden. It would be impossible for a defendant to get records in that case because someone is in counseling doesn't mean that they're, you know, a defendant would be entitled to records. There has to be some correlation at the barest of minimums between the sexual assault that occurred and, or whatever type of issue there may be it medical or counseling or...
So then what you're saying, let me see if I can paraphrase it, I'll try another crack at a third one, that the defendant puts forth a plausible theory supported by something other than whole cloth.
Yes.
It's supported by a minimum relationship to show that it is that it might may be necessary
yes.
for you to look at.
Yes. I mean, I think all three of the justices have perhaps in different ways grasped what I'm trying to argue. I guess perhaps I'm not doing a very good job of it. I'm not sure.
We're the three bears. No, we don't want it too high. We don't want it too low. We want it just right.
Well, if we agreed on something that was just right, why are you entitled to a new trial?
As I indicated, well, I guess it depends on how we define what just right is, but if we agree that the defendant has to present some plausible theory as to how the records would pertain to his defense, the defendant in this case has argued that, essentially denied the allegation. His theory of defense was that it didn't happen. We know that the child in this case has made numerous statements contradictory and failed to report for some period of time what had transpired. We are aware that she did speak with the counselor regarding this issue. There has been a dispute, which to my knowledge is a factual dispute that's never been resolved in this case, whether or not the victim was in counseling at the time or prior to the disclosure. I know the state is of the opinion that she began counseling only at the time.
Why wouldn't it be satisfactory simply to remand for a hearing to see whether there was anything in the records that should have been disclosed?
I believe that would be appropriate. I don't know. I believe that's part of the relief I've asked for.
Didn't you ask for a new trial?
I think I asked for it in the alternative. I'm not sure either.
It's on page 22 of your brief.
Yeah, I asked for a new trial or in the alternative that the case be remanded for an in-camera review of the records. So I believe that you're correct, Your Honor. I don't believe that this court can send this back for simply a new trial, although I guess it could if on this issue. I'm trying to think of a way that, because clearly the trial court would have to review the records and determine whether or not there is anything material at issue in them. And if it found that it was not, well, then I guess there might be another issue for appeal. But I don't know if it would be necessary to remand for a new trial at this point on this issue. So I see my time has expired here.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, counsel.
I do?
You do.
Thank you very much.
All right. Mr. O'Brien, we haven't seen you since 12:15.
Yeah, that's. I was actually able to get something to eat in the interim. But
we were too. All right.
May it please the court.
So representing the state, right?
Assistant Attorney General Daniel O'Brien appears on behalf of the state of Wisconsin in this action. The issues before this court is based on the issues as phrased in the petition for review are: what is the standard of materiality in assessing whether there should be an in-camera review of the victim's mental health treatment records, and what is the standard of appellate review of a decision whether or not to order an in-camera review? I think in the discussion with the opposing counsel, I think Justice Abramson and Bradley have pretty well grasped the difference between the two positions. We the state does request that, and we think it is fair to require the defense to make a specific showing how these sought-after records would be supportive of a defense. What is in there that they that needs to be disclosed, needs to be reviewed, because if it is in there, that it should be disclosed to the defense, as opposed to just a general plausible theory that, well, we believe that there might be something in there that might support a particular theory of defense. And the Hogue case talks about something more than bare conjecture. Well, I think the plausible theory approach is close to the bare conjecture approach that would allow for virtually a fishing expedition in most cases, where the specific showing requirement, it does require the defense to do some work. There's no question about it. This is, after all, an investigation.
Well, how does the defense ever meet that standard, counsel, if they don't know from the beginning what's in there?
You should be reminded that neither the defense nor the state know what's in there. The only person who knows what's in there is the victim.
I'm well aware of that.
Yeah, and the answer is in the many cases that have ordered in-camera review. Our position is consistent with the Court of Appeals standard. It's just a clarification of it. We think the term materiality, or maybe necessary, is equivalent to a likely exculpatory. Because after all, if it's likely inculpatory, the defense won't want it.
That's not my question. My question is, how will the defendant ever be able to make a specific showing absent knowing what's in there?
There are many ways. One is if he talks to the victim and the victim admits, I am in counseling and I have said the following things. If he talks to the victim's mother and the victim's mother admits that there were specific counseling sessions addressing specific issues. If a relative or someone else with knowledge reveals that the victim is suffering from a very specific psychiatric disorder that will affect her ability to remember or to perceive the events accurately, those sorts of things. The Schiffer case is an example where the defense learned through independent witnesses that the victim had a specific psychiatric disorder that related directly to her ability to perceive whether she was sexually assaulted, and that he then went after the records on that basis. It really is no different than a defense who's trying to get at police reports. The defense does not have the right to look at every single police report, say in a homicide case, to see if it contains exculpatory evidence. He usually learns information from his client, from his client, from relatives, from other police officers, whoever, that there might be some information there, and then he says, Your Honor, I have learned the following. I believe that the state is holding on to a police report that contains a specific statement by my client, and I want access to it. Well, what's the basis? Well, I talked to my client's mother. I talked to my client. This is nothing unique here. The defense always has investigative obligations, and they have to go digging for evidence. And in this situation, a defense attorney will often learn. For instance, what if this were a case of a relative, a father or an uncle, molesting a child? Obviously, that relative will have a great deal of information about that child and about what type of treatment, if any, the child is receiving, what kind of disorders she may have, what kind of fantasies she may have. And he learns from that individual, gee, she went into counseling. I wonder if they addressed these issues. I bet they did. Let's ask the judge to review them. So I don't think that it's unduly burdensome when you're balancing that speculative defense need against the interests at stake here.
Well, suppose I say that I'm the defendant, represent the defendant, that it's come to my attention that the alleged victim is under psychiatric, psychological, or other counseling. And I obviously don't know and can't find out what's said at these meetings and what are part of the records, but it's I have every reason to believe that if I get to see these records, that it will show that the victim is not credible, that she changes her story over a course of time, and that she's just not a credible witness. Have I made a good enough showing?
No, I think that that's the sort of vague, conclusory, sort of speculative allegation that the courts have uniformly rejected. The Court of Appeals here and courts in other states, that's basically saying, obviously we're going to challenge the credibility of the victim at trial.
Right,
and you're basically saying, well, she went to counseling. We think there might be something in there that will affect her credibility. Therefore, we get access to it.
Credibility is important, isn't it?
Credibility is important.
Okay.
And if the state had the evidence, it would have to disclose it. But the state doesn't have the evidence.
Okay, well, we'll get to whether the state had access to the evidence and didn't use it. But what I'm trying to get at, which is, I think, the same thing that Justice Babbage is trying to get at, is the state's position apparently is there's got to be a leak somewhere as to what's in those records, either from a family member or the hospital or the clinic or something, because otherwise I just don't know what's in it. I've got to have had a leak about it before I can even get the... All I want, look, I don't want the records. I want the judge to look at the record. And the judge can tell me if there's support of a defense, credibility, or any other defense. So what's the matter with letting the judge look at it?
Because the judge has no right to look at those until the victim waives her privilege and waives the confidentiality of those records.
Well,
and the reason why the
apparently
judge...
apparently got a waiver. The state got a waiver.
I'm sorry?
The state got a waiver here.
Well, we dispute that, but that's...
Okay. All right. That's a good answer.
Let's put it this way. If the state did waive it, then review was improvidently granted in this case, because now we're not under SHFRA and we're under the general discovery statutes and the general right to disclose exculpatory evidence, and the defendant would still have to show a right to access to those records under the discovery statute. And we would submit he can't even do that. But that's another issue. The fact is, assuming the state does not have access to those records, which is true in most SHFRA situations, these are the victim's records. These are not investigative records. These are treatment records. These are no different than someone going to the hospital with a broken arm and a record is made as to what diagnosis and treatment was. These are treatment for sexual assault. It's to make the victim better. The success of the treatment hinges on the privacy of that communication between the child and her doctor or her therapist. And if the therapist, just think, if you were in the position of this victim, and she says, "Doctor, if I tell you this, are you going to tell anybody else?" And he says, "Well, I hope not, and you have a right not to disclose it, but it could be disclosed to a judge, and then, of course, the appellate judge is on appeal, and the judge might disclose it to lawyers, who then might disclose it to a jury, who then might disclose it to other people. And believe me, the value of that therapy crashes at that moment."
Well, if we're looking for a middle ground, and I don't know that your position, I think, should be that you've got the middle ground in the specific showing. But how do you like this? A court should conduct an in-camera review if there is a reasonable likelihood that gets away from needed, maybe needed, reasonable likelihood that the records contain material, and I'm using your words, exculpatory information, useful for the defense, so long as the information is not merely cumulative and the argument is not based on mere speculation. I suppose the defendant wouldn't want exculpatory, but we could even leave that out. Reasonable likelihood that the records contain material information useful to the defense, so long as the information is not merely cumulative and the argument is not based on mere speculation. I try to get rid of your specific showing.
I guess my response to that is that I think it's pretty close to what our position is, because in my brief, my argument would be that you've got to show more than obviously speculation. You've got to tie it to some specific theory of defense. I think one thing you might add to that, and I think that covers that sort of thing. I think it also covers the situation where he says, well, she was in counseling, and there might be some inconsistent statements in there that I can use. You know, that to me falls in the category of speculation and doesn't rise to the level of materiality. So I think that, to that extent, the standard you suggest probably works and avoids the fishing expedition sort of thing. So to that extent, I guess the only thing I'm a little concerned with is that the Benke case out of the Court of Appeals, which is another decision by Judge Brown. Judge Brown wrote Shifra, he wrote Benke, and he wrote this case. And Judge Brown says also, and I think I might add to that, the defendant must show that the records exist. He can't, that the mental health, he can't just speculate that there might be some records out there. You know, he's got to show that and I hope I'm paraphrasing him correctly, you know, and it might just be a threshold showing that there are mental health records, you know, that it's not, that there might be mental health records. But he also, and I think Judge Brown also makes a good point in that case of saying, you know, the defense has no right to discovery in the criminal, no constitutional right to discovery in the criminal context other than under the Brady rule. And therefore, he has no right to have the state fish through these files to see what's in there. That he does have to make a specific showing. And you know, this is the judge who wrote Shifra. And I think there is a need for specificity. And I'm not disagreeing with you. This standard might cover it. I mean, this standard might get us out of the bare conjecture and speculation area. If it's not 100% on line with our proposal, it's close. I guess the likely exculpatory standard I proposed, I think, is close to the U.S. Supreme Court's materiality standard, which again focuses on the reasonable probability of a different result. And obviously, now Pennsylvania v. Ritchie, was a post-trial decision. But I think whether you're looking at pre- or post-trial, you've got to show that there's something there, there's likely something there that will help the defense.
I know, but it doesn't have to change the course of the trial, pre-trial. I mean, the reason you have to have a stronger showing after trial is the interest of finality.
Right. But I would suggest we have another interest here, which is not even present in the analogous confidential informant cases, and that is the interest in protecting the rights of the victim. Because after all, if this victim, you know, the Shifra case says that the victim has the right not to consent, but if she does not consent, then both the state and she are penalized. The penalty being basically the case does not proceed and her assailant walks free. And that's a pretty heavy penalty. And if we're going to impose that penalty, or if we're going to coerce victims to give up their privileges in order to proceed to trial, then I think it's fair to insist on a higher showing from the defense than just bare conjecture, as in New Hampshire, or speculation, or there might be inconsistent statements in there somewhere, that sort of thing. So I think that when you're looking at the weighty interests on the other side of this, the protection of the victim, that the balance requires the defense to make a specific showing. And how the court wants to phrase that specific showing, whether it's a particularized need, likely exculpatory, or as your likelihood of producing material evidence that is not merely cumulative, and that sort of thing, I think that would be of great help.
Mr. O'Brien, let me interrupt you at this point. I'm having trouble understanding why the state isn't satisfied with the second formulation of the standard from SHFRA. What is wrong with a standard that requires that there be a showing of materiality, establishing that the records are relevant and may be necessary to a fair determination of guilt or innocence? Seems to me that's very consistent with Pennsylvania versus Ritchie. What's wrong with that?
Well, I still feel that it's vague. Relevant may be necessary. And to a fair determination of guilt or innocence, so, I mean, arguably inculpatory evidence is relevant and may be necessary.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's assume the trial judge is sitting in, and this is a relatively close situation. Should I grant this request and review these records in camera or not? Which way do you think the court should go? Should the court tip in favor of, well, darn, I'll take a look at the records. What's so terrible about that?
Again, I think that the interest in protecting the rights of the victim in this situation is
the victim's
crucial.
Rights protected when, I'm sorry? Judge, when it's just the judge looking at those records?
But it's not just the judge. It's just the judge if the judge decides not to disclose them and if there's no appeal.
Don't you think that happens with some regularity, that the judge looks at the records and determines that there's nothing there that would be requiring disclosure to the other side? Don't you think that happens with some regularity?
Right, but it also happens with, as the published decisions note, it also happens with great degree of regularity that even when it's not disclosed, not ordered disclosed by the trial judge, it's reviewed by the Court of Appeals and by this court, and therefore, to that extent, the confidentiality is breached, and the victim's privacy interest is compromised. And so I think if it's a close case, the judge should be, if there's some doubt as to the specificity of the defense showing, the judge would be inclined not to order in-camera review. In the confidential informant cases, this court and the Court of Appeals have required very specific showings because of the great interest in protecting the confidentiality of this person, that protecting them from harm. Be a specific showing. And I disagree with the Court of Appeals decisions such as Jessica J.L. and some of the others that say, well, if it's a close case, the judge can do whatever he wants. He can either order a hearing or not order a hearing, a la the post-conviction situation under Bentley, where even if there's an insufficient showing, you can still order a hearing in your discretion. Well, I don't think that's appropriate here, where we have such strong, compelling, countervailing interests in protecting the privacy interests of the victim. Again, unlike the informant situation, we're not dealing with investigative records. We're dealing with a psychiatric clinic, a hospital, or whatever, treatment records, diagnosis and treatment that have nothing to do with the case unless the defense can show that they do. And so there's a significant distinction there. And I think I'm a little concerned that the Schiffer line of cases doesn't pay quite enough attention to the interests of the victim at stake here, and that's why cases such as the Goldsmith decision out of the Maryland Supreme Court are so instructive. And I rely heavily on the Goldsmith case, which basically takes the Pennsylvania v. Ritchie standard and says, yeah, it's got to be likely exculpatory because of this great interest in protecting the privacy interests of the victim. I quoted from the Massachusetts Law Review article on the Bishop case out of Massachusetts, where they talk about the critical need to protect the privacy of the victim, and absent a specific showing by the defense of a need to have, because after all, she's got to sign. If the judge says, I'm going to order in camera review, at that point, whether there's anything in those records or not, the victim either has to sign a release to the judge or the case is dropped, basically. And that's a pretty weighty decision. And it's a weighty decision, I would suggest, not only for the judge but also for the victim. And that's why we don't think it's unfair to require a high showing of need. And again, I think our proposal is close to, if not in line with, the Court of Appeals' proposal. It just clarifies that the showing is that there's got to be something there that's helpful to the defense, not just that it, you know, it's material to the case. It could be exculpatory, it could be inculpatory, it could be neutral, but it might, you know, it might be relevant and therefore it should come in. I mean, it focuses on the defense need for the evidence as opposed to just some sort of nebulous likely material or necessary to a fair determination of guilt or innocence. To me, that's vague. And this, the Goldsmith case focuses on what you're really getting at, what the defense really wants here, and what the defense should be looking for in this kind of a case.
To follow up on Justice Crooks's question, you know, I always thought that our jurisprudence is that words with regard to, for instance, expert testimony, that if an expert testifies, there has to be a threshold standard, and a reasonable probability is the threshold standard. And if an expert testifies for the plaintiff and says it's possible or it may be, that's not enough under our jurisprudence. Those words do not meet the requisite standard. If, under our jurisprudence, if the expert testifies that it's probable, if it's likely, under our jurisprudence, those words mean the same for purposes of expert testimony. One of the things that concerns me, you take the language of Shifra, may be necessary or may be helpful, depending on which part of Shifra you take. But let's say it may be necessary. You take that and you say that is equal to likely to be exculpatory. And there's a dissonance in my mind because maybe to me is not the same as likely. That's a leap. So what's wrong with my approach? Why is likely exculpatory equal to may be necessary?
Yeah, and I guess my answer is the words may be should not be in there. And I know they are in there in Shifra, but in some of the subsequent cases, it's just relevant and necessary to a fair determination of guilt or innocence. In this court, in Solberg, I think even used the phraseology relevant and necessary to a fair determination. And I think if you take out the maybe, because I think you're right, that is, that's kind of a waffling. That's, so yeah, anything's possible. Maybe to me is possibly, and anything's possible. And if anything's possible, then let's just go fishing through all these records. So I think, but if it's a relevant and necessary standard, that's a lot closer to a likely exculpatory, because if it's necessary for the defense, then it's probably exculpatory. Because if the defense needs it, it's going to exculpate them. I mean, or vice versa. And so I think that, yeah, if you put maybe in there, then I think it's lower than the standard we propose. I guess I'll
comments on the standard of review also.
Yeah, I was just gonna address that. The standard of appellate review, as we've proposed in our brief, and I think it's consistent not only with what the Court of Appeals has ultimately done in this line of cases, but what this court has done in other cases, and what I think most courts do, is on the in camera, on the decision whether to order in camera review, that review is de novo. Because we're basically, the appellate court and the trial court are basically reviewing the same offer of proof. It's sort of like the denial of an evidentiary hearing at a post-conviction stage. You look at what did the defense offer, and was that enough to entitle them to an evidentiary hearing? And then
All documentary.
Yeah, pretty much documentary, maybe some oral presentations at a hearing, but you know, it's basically the same evidence. You're not going behind anything to see whether there's a sufficient showing. Once the court orders in camera review and reviews the documents and then says, I am or am not going to release them to the defense, I think at that point it becomes an abuse of discretion or erroneous exercise of discretion review based upon the facts as found by the trial court. And of course that would be with the sealed record of the whatever hearing the judge would make and whatever documents he reviewed, he or she reviewed, and that because I suggest that in that situation it is akin to a ruling on whether or not to admit evidence. The judge has reviewed this and basically determined whether there's anything of exculpatory value in there and has concluded that there is or is not. And I think it's akin to a ruling saying, well, this item of evidence is either irrelevant or it's overly prejudicial, or it's relevant and it's not overly prejudicial. You review that on, you know, whether we would have allowed it in. Did the judge properly exercise discretion? So I think that's the distinction. But at the stage we're at here, where the judge denied in-camera review, you review it de novo. That would be my position. I hesitate to venture into this, but I'm wondering if the court wants me to address this whole business of the release, since, first of all, there is confusion on the record, but it was an issue that came up at trial and was just sort of never addressed as to who got the release and where it went and, you know, what the contours of it were. And it was never developed at trial, even though the parties knew that there was some sort of release. It was never argued by the defense in the Court of Appeals. It was not mentioned in the petition for review, and the petition for review simply said the issues are the materiality standard and the standard of review, and all of a sudden this comes up in a reply brief. And I think if you look at the record, and I'll refer to pages, I believe it's 13 and 14 of the February 10, 1999 pretrial hearing, they touch on the release, and here's the quote from the prosecutor, and I'll rely on this as I close. And as far as the releases, the final paragraph of Rodney Schroffnagel's report, he's a social worker who was involved in the investigation, said Barb, I'll leave her last name out, the mother, signed releases for the information to Mercy Medical Center so the counselor in Appleton could share the information regarding Nadine. But again, the state never received anything further from that statement or any such release. So I think this is really a red herring, and I think we should just assume that the prosecutor could not get access to this stuff and that we're operating under SHFRA. If the court disagrees, then we're not operating under SHFRA, and the defense has to make a separate showing of what right he had access to these records under 97123, even assuming that there was no longer any protection under the privilege or confidentiality provisions. Unless there are any more questions, I'll conclude my argument.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Mr. Griswold, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I guess I'll start where he finished. There was confusion as to the release and to who signed it, or not even who signed it, but who it was for. It was not raised specifically until this point, because it was at the point when I received the state's brief in this case, and I can't recall the exact language, but they indicate that, in theory, that release provided them with opportunity to review those records. At that point, that was an admission by them. I took the opportunity at that point to raise that issue before this court, because it was for the first time relayed to me at any part of the record that that release would have allowed them to get that information. The court can review the record for itself to determine whether or not what that release may or may not have said or what it would have entitled them to, but there definitely was a release signed. That is clear from the record. It's unclear as to whatever happened to it or what it was going to be used for. More specifically, getting onto the SHFRA topic, the state has apparently started out their argument by requiring or asking that this court issue some sort of order that would require a specific showing. I'm still not sure how we can get a specific showing of what records may contain or of what these records, how they would be helpful. He has indicated to this court, well, of the victim or a witness or a relative or somebody may make some statement, well, the victim is in counseling for delusions.
But that, if you don't have something specific in mind, then it is the fishing exhibit. In other words, you're looking, you're hoping to find something. And I'm saying if you don't have something specific.
Our argument is that it's difficult, if not impossible, to find something specific. First of all, you need, according to the state's argument before the court, you need to have somebody essentially give up something about the victim, that she's even in counseling, perhaps, or that he or she has a particular type of problem. If nobody does that, it will be impossible to show specifically what might be in her report.
Or that you know something specific from your, in representing your client. I mean, that...
Yeah, I guess in situations where the client may know the victim or something like that, but that's not always the case. His analogy would be if it's a family situation, but it's not always the case that occurs, and it's difficult in those type of situations to know anything about the victim or what might be in the records. And I would throw out to the court that even if you know something, you know that the victim may have suffered some problem or may be in counseling, it still is difficult to say specifically, well, this is what's going to be in the records. We've never seen the records. We don't know. Turning to a question that Justice Abramson raised, I believe you asked him, let's say that hypothetically you looked at the records and it turns out that the witness was incredible, or not credible, as whatever the case may be, and their response was, well, at that point that still would not be enough to allow these records to be released or to be discoverable to the defense. And I guess I would argue to this court that in these trials, as invariably happens, experts are brought in by the state to testify about what a victim goes through, how a victim is treated, what happens in therapy. Frequently they discuss that victims feel comfortable in therapy, they talk in therapy, those type of things, and issues are worked out. Now, if the records, it's one thing then, I guess our argument would be to be a little bit inconsistent with the police as they're asking questions. But if the therapist actually, the records say, boy, the victim is really all over the board on this and she appears not to know what's going on, I think that would carry a great deal of weight with the jury, not just, well, isn't it true that on October 4th you told us this, and on October 26th you told us this. This would be the treating therapist, not some state expert who's never met the victim and is speaking hypothetically, but these records would demonstrate that perhaps the victim has a problem recollecting events or is incredible because she is all over the board in terms of what happened.
Counsel, do you agree with the state's position that the threshold determination of whether to conduct an in-camera review is reviewed by us de novo?
Is reviewed de novo, is that what?
Yes.
Yes.
And then do you agree with the second prong of their standard of review analysis that if the court determines the decision made, rather, on whether to release or not release after in camera is erroneous exercise of discretion?
Well, I think I've indicated that we really haven't taken a position. It's not before this court because it's not a question that, but I guess, yes, I would agree with the state's opinion on that. I don't think it's necessary in this instance because the records, in fact, weren't turned over for in-camera review, but I could see where if the trial judge did have an opportunity to review the record that they would, of course, be able to this court could then review it on a discretionary basis. The only other thing I'd like to mention, and the state brought it to your attention that this is a matter of victims' rights, and I'd like to present a different scenario. Assuming that a child comes in and they're in counseling, and the child says, you know, are you going to tell anybody about this? No, don't worry about it. You know, our Wisconsin Supreme Court has set forth a good rule. We can't, you know, we won't have to disclose this to anybody. Okay, well, then I really need to tell you that, you know, I lied. I made it up. I didn't like the guy. He was dating my mom. Whatever the case may be. And then where does that leave the defense? There may be an instance, like the state mentioned, where there's a relative or something that may disclose something or say something, but if there's not, those records are sealed, they're privileged, and they won't be accessible to the judge or to the jury or to anybody else.
So. Mr. Griswold, what do you think of reasonable likelihood that the records contain material information useful to the defense, so long as the information is not merely cumulative and the argument is not based on mere speculation? That's what I read.
That was very fast, but...
same one I read earlier.
I know, and I was trying to write it down before. I think that, right off the top of my head, the part about not being cumulative is difficult pre-trial, because there's nothing to be cumulative to. We haven't presented any evidence. I guess we have some police reports, but we don't know how they're going to come in, so it's difficult to say what's going to be cumulative and what's not going to be cumulative. If I recall, the justice indicated something about not being based on mere speculation. Is
yep.
Well, obviously, I think, you know, that would be, that's appropriate, but I think it needs to be made, you know, clear that something could be, I guess the primary issue we come down to is whether or not, if the records are going to show that the victim is incredible, should those records be, or possibly show that the victim has a history of being incredible or has a problem with that, should these records be turned over? And I think that's the issue that we need to deal with. And I believe that your test, as you've iterated, would cover that. And that, so I believe then that the test you've stated would be appropriate. I guess that hopefully answers the court's question.
All right, thank you. That concludes your argument.
Yes.
That concludes the hearing in 001392 Sierra State versus Green. Court wants to thank you, Mr. Griswold, and you, Mr. O'Brien, for presenting the arguments of this evening. And recess until...